111 years ago tomorrow, occurred the martyrdom at Carthage, Illinois, when Joseph and Hiram Smith were killed for their devotion to the church at the hands of a ruthless mob. And while I did not need his approval, I'm glad to say that I talked over with President Graham the propriety of talking about the work of the prophet. And since he agreed with me, I am glad to do what I can in a positive statement with respect to his work. Hiram was somewhat overshadowed by the work of his brother, his younger brother. And so I will not talk especially about Hiram, but will confine my remarks to the work of the prophet. I've always been intrigued by a little statement in Genesis 26th chapter, where it told the story of Isaac after he had gone over in the old country of his ancestors and got himself a lovely wife, came back into Beersheba, and this is are the few lines that I have used quite often. And after getting down to Beersheba, said, "And Isaac digged again the wells of water which they digged in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham." Now we have many, many Philistines who are at work attempting to stop the wells of faith in these modern days. They appear in many forms: worldliness, sin, crime, war, and many other things which I could mention. And so I want to redig the well of faith, which of course has not been stopped, but is interrupted at times with various people in the human founder of the church, Joseph Smith. In doing so, I wish to read the first 10 or 11 verses of the 11th chapter of Matthew, a very interesting story of the Savior and John. And it came to pass, when Jesus had made an end of commanding his 12 disciples, he departed thence to teach and to preach in their cities. Now when John had heard in the prison the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said unto him, "Art thou he of whom it is written in the prophets that he should come, or do we look for another?" Jesus answered and said unto them, "Go and tell John again of those things which ye do hear and see." And here they were: how the blind receive their sight, and the lame walk, and the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached unto them. Now he knew when John would receive that report that he was doing these certain specific things, that John would know of a surety that he was the Messiah. Because, as you will recall, when Jesus began his ministry in the synagogue at Nazareth, he called for the book of the law. And turning to Isaiah, spelled differently in the New Testament than in the Old Testament, he read what Isaiah had said would be the work of the Messiah when he would come, and said 750 years before the Savior appeared. And then he continued, "And blessed is John, and whosoever shall not be offended in me." And as they departed, Jesus began to say unto the multitudes concerning John, "What went ye out into the wilderness to see? Was it a reed shaken with the wind?" At that point, the King James Version stops, but the Inspired Version has this added to that verse: "And they answered him, No. And he said, but what went ye out for to see? Was it a man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they that wear soft raiment are in king's houses. But what went ye out for to see? A prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and more than a prophet. For this is the one of whom it is written, behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee. Now, John, as a prophet of God, ushered in one of the principal dispensations, and that was the dispensation of the Messiah. And we believe that Joseph Smith ushered in another dispensation. And in that respect, they are equal to each other. But I would not attempt to compare them, because comparisons are, they say, invidious. But I believe that we have a right to assume that from this little story, this little account in the 11th chapter of Matthew, that the Lord was indicating at least three things with respect to prophets that probably were essential to a prophet. I do not think we would be taking undue liberties with that account by doing so. I do not believe that the Savior could have picked upon anything in nature more unstable than a reed with its root in the ground, but blown about by every breeze that came along. So let us, in applying these things, ask us ourselves first, what come we out to see? A reed? No. While a reed is a perfect symbol of conformity and instability, I'm sure that Joseph Smith showed by his life's work that he had an inflexible purpose, that he stood firm against all the persecution that came upon him, and that he was killed, suffered death, because he would not conform to those who by whom he was surrounded. I've taken a sort of a human pride in the fortitude and courage of my grandfather. In 1842, he wrote this in a letter: as for the perils which I am called to pass through, they seem but a small thing to me, as the envy and wrath of man have been my common lot all the days of my life. And for what cause, it seems mysterious, unless I was ordained from before the foundation of the world, for some good end or bad, as you may choose to call it. Judge ye for yourselves. God knoweth all these things, whether it be good or bad. But nevertheless, deep water is what I am wont to swim in. It all has become a second nature to me, and I feel like Paul to glory in tribulation. Yes, Joseph Smith was firm and stood firm unto his dying day. Again, do we come to see one who occupies king's chambers, living delicately, I believe, in one of the Gospels, living delicately in king's chambers? No. Poverty was the ordinary lot of Joseph Smith from his boyhood on until his death. His was a frontier family, and even after he inaugurated the work of the church, he spent much time in the western country, where living was certainly had its terrors, as we would think of it today. In 1841, he inventoried his property, and you'd be surprised to see what it was. One horse, two pet deer, six turkeys, a dog, wife, and some household furniture. Certainly, he cannot be charged with having lived high in king's chambers. But what come we out to see? Prophet, let me read that paragraph again. A prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and more than a prophet. For this is he of whom it is written, Behold, I send my messengers before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee. Now we have the record of many prophets in the Gospels, in the record of the Bible, in the old book. But few of them discovered new highways or pointed out the way to them. John, as I said, ushered in the Messiah dispensation. The common definition of a prophet is that of a foreteller or a predictor of events. Now, with respect to that, we can briefly say that the war of the rebellion was foretold by Joseph Smith as early as 1832, the war of the rebellion beginning in 1861. He indicated the state where it would begin, it would start, and stated that the slaves would be drilled and trained to fight against their masters, all of which happened. Shortly before his death in 1844, he spoke of Stephen A. Douglas and said that he was an aspiring man, would try to be president of the United States, but would be unsuccessful. 16 years later, that became a fact. Now, an interesting thing happened with respect to a man by the name of John Hyde. Whether John Hyde was a member of the famous Hyde family in Utah, I do not know. But he came here soon after the trek westward by Brigham Young and some of the saints, and was a missionary for a time being for their church out there, and then apostatized and wrote a book against the church, which was published to the world in 1857. And in that book, he quoted from this revelation or this prediction that Joseph Smith had made, this prophecy about the Civil War, in order to prove that Joseph Smith was a false prophet. Had Mr. Hyde waited 4 years, he would not have used that as an argument against the church or against Joseph Smith. Well, a prominent divine by the name of Edwin Poteet said that there was a rank higher than the mere prophetic. He said, in it is found the emissary and spokesman of God who explores new highways. He says, there have been many such persons, though to be sure they are rare, although I doubt if Edwin Poteet would accept the story of Joseph Smith as we give it to the world. He says to be sure they are very rare. Characteristic of them is their ability not only to see highways yet unmade, but also to nucleate the multitudes around the great vision. Well, Joseph Smith showed that he did have the ability to nucleate the multitudes around his heavenly vision. Joseph Smith pointed the way, that's the nature of God, origin of man, eternal judgment, and presented what is considered as good a definition of truth as has been made by anybody. He brought to the church the revelations containing the doctrines in the Book of Doctrine and Covenants. And of course, the main achievement was the bringing forth of the Book of Mormon. But now I'm going to show that he pointed the way in two mighty divisions of science. Now, the universe was thought in 1830 when the Book of Mormon came forth and the church was organized that scientific men of the day knew the extent of creation. They believed they knew all about the universe, just what it consisted of. We had telescopes in 1830, but they were growing gradually larger. And quoting from some recognized astronomers of recent years, we find this, that the Harvard University announced the discovery of 50,000 galaxies. Now, this is just a few years ago. Announced the discovery of 50,000 galaxies of stars never before observed, each galaxy containing several billion stars. It is estimated that there are at least 2 million such island universes scattered through space. And Dr. Shapley of Harvard said that surveys of the immensities of space stretch more than 6 quadrillions of miles in all directions from the sun and its planets, and that light, which travels 186,000 miles per second, traverses this space in approximately 1 million years. And Dr. Hubble of Mount Wilson Observatory said with the 100-inch telescope that they have there, nebulae are located which show an unbroken sequence of change from clouds of glowing material to stars in huge spirals. Each spiral is a universe, that there are 1,200 of these nebulae, all of these in a zone so far away that it has taken 7 million to 10 million light years for them to be seen by us. Now that was said after experience with the 100-inch telescope at Mount Wilson. Now with the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar, California, I understand that their discoveries are extended and that they can see just so far, and then with the dust of all these universes, accumulated dust, it looks like they have seen about as far as they're going to. Now with this background, which I think is authentic with respect to this science, universe, let us consider Doctrine and Covenants, 22nd section. Now that, in the 22nd section, we find the story of Moses talking to the Lord face to face. And he had seen shown something of the extent of creation. And Moses inquired, wanted to know the history of it. And the Lord limited him to this earth. And he said, worlds without wonders have I created. But only in account of this earth and the inhabitants thereof give I unto you, for behold, there are many worlds which have passed away by the word of my power, and there are many also which now stand, and numberless are they unto man. But all things are numbered unto me, for they are mine, and I know them. And here follows a remarkable statement. He didn't say it occurred in the past. It is something that is happening then, present tense. As one earth shall pass away, and the heavens thereof, even so shall another come. And there is no end to my works, for they are my work and my glory to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. Here was a statement that at this time, in this present age of ours, new worlds are being formed out of primeval matter. As one earth shall pass away, so shall another come. Now, in the Kansas City Star for May 8th, 1939, we found an article from McDonald's Observatory headed, New Stars Still Are Being Created, a Telescope Reveals. And this telegram came from McDonald's Observatory, Fort Davis, Texas, saying, the main architectural plan of creation, which reveals how stars were made, and that new ones still are being created out of primeval matter, has been discovered by the world's greatest telescope. The world's greatest telescope then, 100-inch telescope. Now we have the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar in California. So, we feel that Jonah Smith said something with respect to creation, even the scientists of his day probably never have made, but they now make it because of the use and advantage of these great telescopes. A scientist 25 years ago made a statement with respect to the universe, which is very interesting, because scientists of today, professor of Harvard University, has written an article about the sun, indicating the process by which the sun throws off tremendous amounts of heat every second without any special loss. And while people used to think that star, the sun sometime would become a dead star. They think that this loss is so slight that maybe the sun might become a dead star in 200,000 years. Well, I'll let my grandson worry about that. This scientist said the universe is often looked upon as a machine, a great piece of construction which was made in order to go and goes accordingly. The universe has therefore some kind of power or motive force within it. Other scientists hold that the universe, though it is a machine and needs power to run it, is nevertheless a perpetual motion machine, whose power to go is inseparably bound up with it, so that it can never run down. Well, that looks like it might apply to the sun, according to that scientist. But the supreme discovery of science is finding the orderliness. That word is, you must remember, the orderliness that exists in the universe. Is there some larger unit, this fellow inquired, that includes groups of galaxies? And we say that the scientists say yes. To a scientist, the most interesting thing then is not great numbers, violent forces, long periods of time. Rather, the scientist is awestruck by the orderliness that he observes in all parts of the universe. There's no chaos, nothing haphazard, and nothing capricious. Now, these are authentic statements from scientists. And I would like to read what Joseph Smith wrote in the 85th section of the Doctrine and Covenants 120 years ago. All kingdoms have a lawgiver, and there are many kingdoms, for there is no space in the which there is no kingdom. And unto every kingdom is given a law, and unto every law there are certain bounds also and conditions. Then he added, judgment goeth before the face of him who sitteth upon the throne, and governeth and executeth all things. He comprehendeth all things, and all things are before him, and all things are round about him, and he is above all things, and in all things, and is through all things, and is round about all things, and all things are by him, and of him even gone forever and ever. That puts God into everything, every particle of the universe. The earth rolls upon her wings, and the sun giveth light by day, and the moon giveth her light by night, and the stars also giveth their light. As they roll upon their wings, in their glory, in the midst of the power of God, unto what shall I liken these kingdoms, if ye may understand? Behold, all these are kingdoms, and any man who hath seen any or the least of these has seen God moving in his majesty and power. Now, with these statements in your thinking, I want to read the sixth section of the 85th section, sixth paragraph. And the light which now shineth, which giveth you light, is through him who enlighteneth your eyes, which is the same light that quickeneth your understanding. Now that statement has given me a lot of food for thought. It didn't say that quickeneth your brain. It said that quickeneth your understanding. And now medical men and scientists have discovered that when a person's brain is operated, when he's thinking, that if there emanates from his brain certain light, which they've been able to discover, and not only discover, but measure, and learn the characteristics of it. And it is said by them to be the same, has the same characteristics as the light that comes from the sun. So that our understandings are quickened by the same power. Which light proceedeth forth from the presence of God to fill the immensity of space? The light which is in all things, which giveth life to all things, which is the law by which all things are governed, even the power of God who sitteth upon his throne, who is in the bosom of eternity, who is in the midst of all things. Here we are shown that the power of God is in every atom and particle of the earth, not only the earth, but the universe as well. 41 years ago, a scientist, the name of H.G. Wells, English writer, wrote a an article called A Prophetic Trilogy, published in the Century magazine. It was called A Trap to Catch the Sun. And even in those days, 41 years ago, scientists were wondering how they could capture this energy which they knew was coming from the sun. And he had a bottle of uranium oxide, and he showed it to his congregation in Edinburgh, this man Wells. And he said, we know now that the atom that once we thought hard and impenetrable and indivisible and final and lifeless is really a reservoir of immense energy. A little while ago, he said, we thought of the atom as we thought of bricks, as solid building material, as substantial matter, as unit masses of lifeless stuff. And behold, these bricks are boxes, treasure boxes, boxes full of the intensest force. Then he held up this bottle. He said, this little bottle contains about a pint of uranium oxide. That is to say, about 14 ounces of the element, uranium. It's worth about one English pound, or about $5 United States, at that price, at that time. In this bottle, he said, ladies and gentlemen, in the atoms in this bottle, there slumbers at least as much energy as we could get by burning 160 tons of coal. If at a word, in one instant, I could suddenly release that power, here and now, it would blow us and everything about us to fragments. If I could turn it into the machinery that lights this city, that was the city of Edinburgh, Scotland, it would keep Edinburgh brightly lit for a year. Then he added this, in closing, but at present, no man knows, no man has anything of how this little lump of stuff can be made to hasten the release of its source. Now, we all know scientists have discovered just how to do that. That is the origin of atomic energy and atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs. Kansas City Star for May 5th, 1940 had an article called Atomic Power on Tap, and they were beginning to visualize what they could do with this atomic energy if properly used. And the scientists are still working with all that, and our government, especially President Eisenhower, trying to get an arrangement with all the nations so that we can develop atomic energy in along industrial and peaceful lines, and we don't know yet what the outcome will be. But this Kansas City Star article said that laboratory isolation of a new chemical substance, 1 pound of which is said to be capable of yielding power output of 5 million pounds of coal or 3 million gallons of gasoline. And a writer wrote in Harper's Magazine in 1914, only 15 years ago, that science had won this first battle, had found out how to release this vast store of energy. And he speculated as to what might be done in an industrial way, and stated that a small amount built into a house when it was erected could keep the house cool in the summer and warm in the winter until the house would fall down from natural causes. That a small amount could be built into an automobile by the application of moisture to that uranium, run that automobile until it would wear out. All these things are pleasant to think about. But just a thought, and I'm trying to make this as brief as possible. We have some idea about smallness. We think of little things, but it's just absolutely impossible for us to really visualize or understand how small an atom is. A uranium atom's diameter is calculated to be a third to a half of a billionth of an inch. But the nucleus is confined to a space limited at 100,000 times smaller. Surely we can't comprehend that. The space between this center and the uranium circumference is filled with 92 electron skirting around in there. There's movement in there. And this atom, which is only a part of a billionth of an inch in size. Then speaking with respect to the power to be released from the atom, on June 6, 1917, that's during the First World War, a munitions ship blew up in a collision in Halifax Harbor, Nova Scotia. There were 1,500 persons were killed, 4,000 injured, 20,000 made homeless. 2.5 square miles of the city devastated. Now that munitions ship carried 3,000 tons of TNT, which was supposed to be the most explosive thing in the world during the First World War. Yet, that explosive force of that 3,000 tons of TNT is just 1/7 of the explosive power of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's the atomic bomb. Now we have the hydrogen bomb and some improvements on that. Some years ago, one of the railroad companies started to revise or remodel one of their big engines to use atomic energy. And I think we will see it soon. And these trains will be brought about the country by atomic energy, just as we have known of it in the submarine, the Nautilus, run by the energy from the atom. Others are to be made. And we're on the threshold of much development along that line. Now I go back and read section 86. And the light which now shineth, which giveth you light, is through him who enlighteneth your eyes, which is the same light that quickeneth your understanding, which light proceedeth forth from the presence of God to fill the immensity of space. Dr. John Lorham, some 60 or 70 years ago, talked about these early prophets. Some of us who did some work in philosophy will remember the very crude efforts made by some of those early so-called philosophers to account for the nature of the world and matter and so forth. When we dropped bombs on Japan, a prominent Kansas City minister, one of the secular churches, said to why. He says, God is in every atom. And he stated that it was God's power let loose on the heathen. And at that time, President Truman thanked God and said, I wonder if God, in his infinite wisdom, has not seen fit to reveal to his civilization the secret of the atomic bomb. I believe God did do that. And I am sorry that we couldn't keep that within our own country. Because potential destruction of everybody is in the hands of ruthless people. The future of the world is in the hands of a majority, if we have a majority, of goodwill. Otherwise, they may all suffer destruction. Now, I believe that all these things, Joseph Smith pointed the way. You must remember that he spoke as a layman. If he had used scientific terms, he would have been more suspect than he was. And I believe that he said these things, the same things that scientists are now saying, in his own terminology, his own words. And of course, that's all he could do. So, what come we out for to see? Certainly we find a man who was stable, and who persisted in his devotion and was finally made a sacrifice on the altar of religious freedom. And so we wonder if he died in vain. Of course, Latter-day Saints would say no. I believe experience would justify us in saying no. I believe consideration of many of these things would answer in the negative. And so, quoting from some unknown author, they never die, they never fail who die in a great cause. Their block may soak their gore, Their heads may sodden in the sun. Their limbs be strung to the city gates and castle walls. But still their spirit walks abroad. Am I justified in believing the spirit and genius of the prophet Jonah Smith still walks abroad?